Stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
Welcome back to Administrative Static. Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione here. And there is another decision this past week from the U.S. Court of Appeals. This one decided on March 25th in the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. The Sixth Circuit covers Michigan, Ohio, Tennessee, and Kentucky. And it happens to be the circuit where I clerked in Louisville, Kentucky, once upon a time. The court sits in Cincinnati. And this case involved the bump stock ban, which our listeners in Colorado, you're aware of the case that had been pending in the 10th Circuit. Well, this is a same issue about the bump stocks, but the 6th Circuit has come out the opposite way. So just for those who didn't hear our earlier discussion of what happened in the 10th Circuit, there was a panel decision last May that had upheld the bump stock ban. Then the 10th Circuit decided to rehear the entire case en banc, or I guess 11 of the 12 judges, one of them was recused, heard the decision or reheard the panel, the arguments and so forth. And then earlier this year, the 10th Circuit did something which is extremely rare, which is that they dismissed the en banc rehearing after the oral arguments had already occurred. And then there were 5 dissents from that. And the dissenters all agreed with NCLA and said that the bump stock ban was a violation, was a misinterpretation of the statute, and that ATF didn't have the authority to issue the regulation and so forth. So we were really happy to see this Sixth Circuit decision come down. This case is Gun Owners of America v. Garland, and the panel there was, the opinion was written by Judge Alice Batchelder, and Eric Murphy joined in the majority decision. And then Helene White was the dissenter in the Sixth Circuit. But as I say, the issue is the same. The question is whether or not a bump stock can be classified as a machine gun under 26 U.S.C. Section 5845B. But as Judge Batchelder points out right at the outset of her decision, the case really rests as much on who gets to determine the statute's meaning as it does on what the statute means. And that who, is it the agency? Does the agency get deference for that determination? Or does the court independently get to determine what the statute means? And so Judge Batchelder digs first into that question of who determines the statute's meaning. And what she says is that because an agency's interpretation of a criminal statute is not entitled to Chevron deference, and because the ATF's final rule is not the best interpretation of Section 5854B, we reverse the district court's judgment and remand for proceedings consistent with this opinion. That last language is boilerplate that you often see in there. Just means that the case will be sent back to the district court to sort of tie up loose ends. And in this case, this was like the 10th Circuit case. This was up on a preliminary injunction. So the Sixth Circuit granted a preliminary injunction to Gun Owners of America for the states of, again, Michigan, Ohio, Kentucky, and Tennessee. So the bump stock ban is currently not in effect in those 4 states. And interestingly, the government, the ATF and DOJ, asked for the Sixth Circuit to stay its decision, presumably pending an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court or something like that. And the Sixth Circuit refused. They said, no, this is a preliminary injunction. You have misinterpreted the statute. You have abused your power, and we are not going to leave your ruling in place. So the arguments that NCLA has been making in the 10th Circuit and in the 5th Circuit in a different case, our 10th Circuit case is called Apotian, our 5th Circuit case is called Cargill. Again, we're talking about the 6th Circuit case here, Gun Owners of America, but they all involve whether or not the bump stocks are machine guns. So as I said, Judge Batchelder first jumps into the question of who makes the decision here. And I mentioned Chevron deference. That's the idea that when you're dealing with a regulatory agency's interpretation of a statute, that if there's an ambiguity in the statute and the agency reasonably interprets that ambiguity, resolves the ambiguity with a reasonable interpretation of the statute, then under Chevron, judges are supposed to defer to the agency's interpretation. And there are lots of problems with that. Go ahead,
Vic. It's not an idea. It's a Supreme Court case, right?
Yes, it's a precedent.
It's a precedent. So it's
binding precedent. Courts have to do that, whether they agree with Chevron or not. But Chevron doesn't apply in all cases. And so one of the kinds of cases that Chevron doesn't apply to, or at least that Judge Batchelder says this in her decision, is criminal cases. And, you know, I think it makes sense when you think about it that that you don't want the prosecutor to be writing the criminal law. You don't want the executive branch that is in charge of enforcing the law to also be the one that's creating new criminal liability. The responsibility for creating criminal liability under our Constitution rests with Congress, not with the executive branch. And so it's troubling to have ATF create 500,000 new felons overnight by reinterpreting a bump stock to be a machine gun. And the district court had found that the ATF's interpretation was entitled to Chevron deference and that the final rule's classification of bump stocks as machine guns was a permissible interpretation of the statute. And so the first step that the Judge Batchelder makes is to step back and say, well, wait a minute, Chevron deference, and I'm quoting here, Chevron deference categorically does not apply to the judicial interpretation of statutes that criminalize conduct, i.e. that impose criminal penalties, because and the definition of machine gun, let me just finish this quote, because the definition of machine gun in 5845B applies to a machine gun ban carrying criminal culpability and penalties, we cannot grant Chevron deference to the ATF's interpretation. Go ahead, Vec.
And that's a big deal because although we always thought that was the case, and it's probably the majority rule, it's not clear that everywhere everyone would have come out with that outcome.
Well, in fact, the Tenth Circuit did not come out that way in our case in Apotian. So there is now a circuit split on that exact question of whether or not you get Chevron deference. The panel decision that was reinstituted in the Tenth Circuit in our case held that there was Chevron deference to the agency's interpretation, despite the fact that it was a criminal statute. And you know, among the reasons why, and Judge Batchelder goes into this in great detail, and I commend her decision to anyone who is who's interested in this question, because I think that she writes well. It's a very lucid and easy to read decision, which you can't always say about judicial decisions, but she's good at her craft. She makes the point that I was just talking about, that you can't have the same branch, the executive branch, both writing the law and executing the law. There's a violation of the separation of powers there. But she also points out that criminal laws are supposed to reflect the moral judgments and expertise of the community. And that's why the ability to make things illegal is given to Congress, because Congress is the branch of government that best reflects the moral judgments and expertise of the community. And then the third point she makes is that there's something called the rule of lenity. And this is something we've stressed in all of our cases. The rule of lenity dictates that if there's an ambiguity, that in order for a criminal defendant to have fair notice that they violated the law, you need to interpret that ambiguity in favor of the criminal defendant. So in other words, if Congress wants to make something illegal, it has to be clear that it's making it illegal. Now, there are ways to deal with loopholing of the law and so forth, but the basic point is you don't get to write a vague criminal law and then have the executive branch say, oh, yeah, that falls within that too, and that falls within that as well. And so I think correctly, Judge Batchelder said that the rule of lenity takes precedence over Chevron here, and you have to apply that because the statute has criminal consequences. And when you apply the rule of lenity to any ambiguity in the statute, then there's no room for Chevron at that point. So where does this leave us? This leaves us with the Sixth Circuit having to interpret the statute on its own without deferring to the agency's interpretation of the statute. And when it comes down to a statutory interpretation, the Sixth Circuit doesn't really have much trouble finding that that under the statutory definition that bump stocks are not machine guns. There's this phrase that's important in these cases about the single function of the trigger. And what the Sixth Circuit focuses on is, look, whether you're dealing with a bump stock or you're dealing with a semi-automatic weapon that does not have a bump stock, just sort of a standard stock on a semi, either way, if you depress the trigger one time, you get one bullet. The bump stock doesn't change that. It's still, the trigger still has to reset with every bullet fired. And that makes it very different from a machine gun. The whole thing that separates semi-automatic weapons from machine guns is that trigger function. It's can you just hold the trigger down and then have the machine gun just fire until it's out of bullets? That's what a machine gun does. You have to physically touch the trigger a separate time for each bullet fired when you're dealing with a semi-automatic weapon. And that still remains true when there is a bump stock attached to that. Now, does a bump stock accelerate the process? Yes, because it allows this bump firing technique where when you're pushing out on the stock of the gun or of the forestock of the gun underneath the barrel, you push forward with that with your non-trigger hand while you're pulling back on the rest of the gun with your trigger hand, and you just keep your trigger finger stationary in front of the trigger. The recoil of the gun allows the trigger to bump against your stationary finger, and that process happens more rapidly than most people can pull the trigger repeatedly. And so it doesn't change the actual mechanism, the way that the trigger functions. And so the Sixth Circuit says, look, this isn't a machine gun. And they're not deferring to the ATF. So I think this is a great result and happy to see it. This means that there's now a circuit split between the Tenth Circuit and the Sixth Circuit. And so I would expect the Department of Justice to take this up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and I would expect the U.S. Supreme Court to hear the case. But there may be other cases that make it up there as well, including the Tenth Circuit case, which was decided earlier this year. That might make it up there first. Stay tuned for more.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Administrative Static. This is John Vecchione. I'm here with Mark Chenoweth. And this is a fun one. It's not fun for the client, but it is kind of a fun case for attorneys. Federalist Media has been caught in the maw of the National Labor Relations Board just because its publisher, Ben Dominic, tweeted out a joke. A very liberal online publication was in some kind of labor trouble, and Ben tweeted out to his employees that if anyone tries to unionize, it's to the salt mines with them. And the Federalist does not own any salt mines, has no access to salt mines. And in fact, it doesn't even have offices. Everyone works out of their homes. So the ability to round everyone up and send them to the salt mines is missing. But some officious intermeddler, as we say in the law, somebody who I think the young people would call it a Karen, somebody who has no fight, no skin in the game, said, I don't like that joke. And I think it chills the ability to unionize of the Federalist writers.
And even though there was no incipient unionization movement taking place at the time, as far as we know.
Correct. No. And two of the people said it was a joke anyway. Two of the writers put in an affidavit saying it was a joke. Everyone knows it's a joke. And so the whole thing, the administrative law judge of the NLRB said, nope, he's an aggrieved person. Under the statute, you have to be an aggrieved person to complain. So whoever this person was out in New
York, I just want to point out, you're right about the statute, but the regulation that NLRB has put out says any person can file. So that's one of the big disputes here is the discrepancy between the regulation that says any person and the statute that says aggrieved person.
Correct. And so under any, you're aggrieved. I mean, people, there are people who wake up in the morning aggrieved. But if you don't, if you're not unionizing and you have no, skin in the game, why should you be able to bring these people God knows where and have the NLRB tell them they have to take their tweets down or fine them or whatever. So anyway, but the long story short, the ALJ ruled that this was a terrible violation and indeed that there's no joking around in NLRB. And then the NLRB itself, it went up to the board and the administrative agency in its full wisdom and discretion said, yep, that's what we're saying. No joking around here. So we have appealed it. NCLA has appealed it on behalf of our clients, the Federalist Pub Media LLC. And we were very happy to get some amicus curiae support this week. And we got a number of them. But I just want to point out, because I think that this amicus brief is of some interest because it's people who you wouldn't think would take that much interest in the law. The brief for the amicus curiae here is the Cato Institute and Reason Foundation and Individual Rights Foundation and the Liberty Project, but a couple of law professors and a union member, Corn Revere and James Barton. But the folks and Clay Calvert. Well, the folks I want to bring up are, we have both P.J. O'Rourke, who I have a number of his books on my shelf here, Peace Kills.
Famous humorist.
Give War a Chance, All the Trouble in the World, Parliament of Whores, Age
and Guile. I guess you'd say.
So there's he's got his enemies list. So anyways, I read a lot of P.J. and I've seen him around town here on occasion outside watering holes.
Eat the Rich is his, right? Doesn't he have Eat the Rich?
Yes, and Eat the Rich. And also Penn and Teller. They're sort of comedic magicians, and they're on TV quite a bit. And they have the one show that I won't say its name on the radio, but they also...
Fooled us. It's okay to say it.
Okay, we'll use that one. But in any event, so... But they have put in an interesting brief, and it's interesting because they say, listen, he sent this out on his personal Twitter account, Ben did, and he sent it to 83,000 people. No one violates the labor laws in broad daylight like that if they're serious. They point out they have no access to salt mines in any event. But one of the things they have here is... this case concerns Amici because we are committed to preserving free expression and edgy humor, which I apparently have to go to court to preserve that now. When an obvious joke is misinterpreted as an illegal threat, everyone became a little more frightened that the next thing they say or tweet might get them hailed into court. So I think that's the nub of it. But I'm very, they make a number of points here. And they bring up a lot of statements by people that could be actionable if serious. And one of them that I really like, because I did watch this White House Correspondents' Dinner, was this. Sasha and Malia are huge fans, but boys, talking to the Jonas Brothers, boys, don't get any ideas. I have two words for you. Predator drones. You will never see it coming. You think I'm joking. President Barack Obama, White House Correspondents' Dinner Address, 2010. So obviously...
sounds like a death threat.
Yeah, it sounds like a death threat. I watched that, and I thought his timing was very good. I thought it was very good, and I'm glad he wasn't sued in his personal capacity for the terrible threat to the Jonas Brothers.
Right. Harmless humor, right? I mean, come on.
And Ilya Shapiro, who is the lead counsel on the brief, along with our friend Trevor Burrus, writes for the Federalist. So he said, listen, we saw it. It's a joke. We know it's a joke. And he also said it's funny. And I thought that this was a pretty good statement by E.B. White. I heard it before, but I'd forgotten it. Of course, explaining why a joke is funny is a daunting task. As E.B. White said, humor can be dissected as a frog can, but the thing dies in the process. And I think that what the NLRB wants is for all jokes to die in the process. And it really happens. So, well, we couldn't get P.J. O'Rourke and we couldn't get Penn here, but Teller's here. And I want to thank you for putting in this Amici. Very interesting. I'm obviously perhaps, joking. Go ahead.
Perhaps
go ahead.
Like the student in the Dead Poets Society, Teller is exercising his right not to speak.
Exactly. He doesn't want to break character. It's an interesting case, and I'm highlighting this because obviously you can, if something that is, if there's very few assaults on free speech as bad as this, because you think about this for a minute. We had serious labor problems at the beginning part of the last century and the end of the previous century. There were, you know, violence broke out. There was all kinds of things going on. And you had serious, they'd round up the Pinkerton detectives. They'd do all kinds of things. And the unions would also do all kinds of things. So we passed this law. But do you think that if a humorist had said something about unionization?
Yeah, Mark Twain or Will Rogers or something like that.
Right? Will Rogers would totally say something like this, and I think the bosses want to send him to the salt mines, you know, and he'd swing his lariat around, and that would happen. But they had real problems back then, so I don't think they'd be monitoring this, to tell you the God's honest truth. And I do think that it's important here because if an agency can allow anyone in the country to complain, anyone in the country, not even a, it would be one thing if an employee came and, you know, this was a veiled threat. He acted like it was a joke, but it wasn't a joke. And then you could fight about that. But here,
that would deserve investigation. You know, you're right. That's different.
Right. But everybody in the organization who's actually getting paid a salary, who actually has a right to organize, who actually has a right to unionization, says, you got to be kidding me. So all these people, now think about this.
Well, and they joked back too, Vec. They said things like, well, maybe if you built us a building, we could walk out of it. Or,
that's,
you know, the only salt you have is the salt on the margaritas you make for us or something. You know, I mean, it was jokes like that back. So they understood the joke.
There's no question that's true. But also think what this does. An administrative agency has made speech harder to make and will punishes you for your speech, for a joke, for a tweet that went out to 85,000 people that applied to your employees that all your employees thought were a joke. But now somebody who has no relation to your organization and may hate your organization is now getting your employees to have to be distracted and go put in declarations for people like Mark and I to put before the NLRB and eventually courts. The boss, Ben, has to comment on this and worry that the organization's going to be fined or that he's going to have to withdraw as a journalist, something he wrote.
The legal cost of this, Vec, for anybody who wasn't getting free help from NCLA would be enormous. I mean, just for that reason alone, most people would cave and take down the tweet. You can't afford a six-figure defense on something like this.
Well, there's no truer word spoken, because you know who had to take down a tweet is Elon Musk. The richest man in the country. Elon decided, I'll go to Mars. I'll make flamethrower tchotchkes for you. I'll bore through the earth. But, I can't. I got to pull my tweet because the NLRB said so. So if Elon didn't think it was worthwhile, and he's got, he can power his rockets with burning cash if he wanted. And I think that just shows how hard this is and how difficult it is and why we got to be out there. So in any event, on that note, we'll see you next time.
Well, I want to say a quick thank you to Tech Freedom, Southeastern Legal Foundation, the Institute for Free Speech, Pacific Legal Foundation, and NFIB for all filing amicus briefs in the case as well. And Elon Musk may not be able to stand up for free speech when it comes to his tweets, but Teller could, so that's good.
I'm glad he was here, and I want to thank